Well, as I said a while ago, if you tuned in this afternoon to hear Todd Wilken, we have a surprise for you. Ken Sherb filling in for Todd on Issues Etc. this afternoon. In a moment, we're going to be talking about preaching to modern man and one of the great 20th century exemplars of preaching to modern man. But we need to get a little bit of an update from the aforementioned Todd Wilken and find out exactly what he's been doing and what's keeping him away from the microphone. So, without further ado, I present to you, making a cameo appearance on his own show, Todd Wilken.
Ken, it's good to talk to you.
What's going on?
Well, I'm down here in Dallas visiting family. I usually do that right around this time of the year. It's a pretty good time to get away during the Christmas holiday. This one stretched a little bit longer because right before we were getting ready to come down here, I discovered that I had failed to take into account my dad's retirement party, which is going to be tomorrow afternoon, and so it's extended our vacation a little bit here down in Dallas. He's retiring after 42 years with his business, and didn't want to have to miss that.
Well, I understand that perfectly. And by the way, thank you for taking a couple extra days. It has been fun for me to
sit
here.
Well, I know you enjoy it, Ken.
Do the radio do. What do we have to look forward to when you get back? Any big plans, big ideas for the show for this year?
Well, this year is the second year we're doing our Issues Etc. Book of the Month. This has worked out beautifully because it's a perfect marriage between the task of Issues Etc., which is, among many other things, our main task being to defend the faith and teach the truth, but also to equip the people of God and to equip the church. And through this offering of monthly books and the people we get to talk to and connect in connection with those subjects, it has been marvelous. We're going to start out this month in January with the Complaint Psalm book. It's called When God Becomes My Enemy, and I love dealing with that kind of real-life Christian subject where we don't have a candy-coated Christ or a sugar-coated God. We've got a real God for real Christians in their real lives, and I just hope to continue that through 2004.
One of the great things about Issues Etc., I have always said as I've listened to the program, is the variety. I mean, think about the lineup this afternoon, Todd. We had in our first half hour Uwe Simonetto looking back at the year 2003 in the top religion stories. Then we had Paul Grimm talking about Luther and music. Last hour, Paul Meyer and Will Wheaton both talking about Epiphany and doing that from various points of view. We've got a segment this half hour on preaching to modern man, and next half hour we're talking about Mars exploration. I don't know that there is a program in radio where you range that kind of different waterfront of topics and do it every day.
There isn't. There isn't a program like that, and that's why I know you feel privileged to be associated with it, and I certainly do. And we need to say that the variety that, and I've heard this from many people over the last 5 years, just the waterfront, this vast waterfront of subjects that we're dealing with on a daily basis, the credit for a lot of that is due to the fact that we have one of the very best producers in radio. I'm convinced Jeff Schwarz, who's the unsung hero of Issues Etc., he's the one that makes sure all those topics and guests come to our listeners. He's a great pleasure to work with. It's a little intimidating sometimes because, you know, usually people think of the host being more on top of the subjects than anyone else who works in the operation. But at Issues Etc., it's usually the producer who's far more up to speed. And he keeps the hosts up to speed.
By the way, I just got a note from the producer. He says that on Sunday night, it's going to be Mike Horton you'll be talking to from the White Horse Inn about postmodernism and pop culture.
It's going to be great. Mike, no one is better than who has a keener eye on the church and the culture than Mike Horton. He's written some tremendous books on that subject, and he's one of the very best that we bring on. We're happy to have him. I'm looking forward to Sunday night. You know, Ken, I heard the weather forecast up there. What's the temperature in St. Louis?
22.
You know how cold it was here 2 days ago in Dallas?
Do I want to know?
It was 79 degrees. It was actually a record. But it was, we were outside in shirt sleeves, and we actually turned on the air conditioning.
So let me get this straight. You are coming back, right?
Yes, absolutely. Actually, this coming weekend, I'm going to be going to Fargo, actually an hour and a half north of Fargo, North Dakota. And I talked to a pastor up there where I'm going to be preaching on Sunday. And he said it was 19 degrees below zero temperature, 47 below zero wind chill factor. So I'm going to go from one extreme to the next.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Well, we're looking forward to having you back here at the Issues Etc. microphone. That's Thursday, right?
Absolutely. A full day Thursday, and if we can manage it, a full day Friday as well.
Wonderful. Great to talk to you, Todd. Have a safe trip back and a blessed Epiphany.
And Ken, thank you so much for helping out. It is just, I know it's a pleasure working with you. Jeff has said it is. And I sit here without a bit of worry or a bead of sweat when I know that you're sitting behind the microphone.
Kind of you to say, Todd. Have a good day.
And you as well.
God bless. That's Todd Wilkin calling in from Texas, telling us what's going on in his world, and he will be back here live once again Thursday afternoon for Issues Etc. If you recall, if you've been with us all afternoon, Uwe Simonetto of UPI told us in the first hour of the program this afternoon that Roman Catholics in France have now initiated a new thing. They are targeting particular sermons, especially at intellectuals, at the intelligentsia. This is something, he said, that's relatively new. Well, I'm not too sure what his frame of reference is, but there was somebody who was preaching to intelligentsia for a good number of years in the 20th century. His name was Helmut Thielicke, university professor at the University of Hamburg, taught systematic theology, but was probably better known worldwide, certainly in this country, as a preacher. And our guest to talk with us about the life and work of Helmut Thielicke, who was a sort of a typical, maybe prototypical, preacher to modern man, is a former professor of mine, Dr. Harold Zietlow, professor emeritus of practical theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. Zietlow's doctorate is in philosophical theology from the University of Chicago, and he spent a year studying with Helmut Thielicke in Germany. Dr. Zietlow, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thanks for inviting me.
It's wonderful to have you here. Tell us, just in a few sentences, who was Helmut Thielicke?
He was a well-known preacher in Germany. He was one who confronted Nazism, and he was such a powerful preacher that when he preached, the Nazis came there to hear and see if there was something that he would say negative against Hitler or Nazism. And after hearing his sermon, instead of demanding a Heil Hitler, as they came out and greeted Thielicke, they said, "The Lord bless you." So they were. That's how persuasive he was. He's such a powerful speaker that even these Nazis who were in power, they became listeners, and he had that effect in his time. He preached in a large church. The large one in Hamburg, Germany, big, tall, copper tower on it turned green with the age. And that's a large city in Germany in the harbor. That's where we landed on the last trip of the SS Berlin when we went over there for 12 months. I was given 12 months to study. Had several of these sabbaticals over, 30, 40 years of teaching in seminaries. And I thought that the best way I could spend that time was to go and study with Helmut Thielicke, who was a very prolific writer and man known all over the world. He had also come to the United States and traveled and preached. I can remember once he was in Columbus, Ohio, I sponsored him at a theological seminary and then had him in my home. And I had a chance, the Germans call it, after we eat in the evening, to have a Spaziergang. That is, you have a walk which is for pleasure, and after you eat, we were walking along Elm Avenue and Parkview Street in Bexley, east suburb of Columbus, Ohio. And I asked him, I notice in your theology that you make so much over God as a father. You know, he wrote a book with the title, Our Heavenly Father.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, how come you make such an emphasis on the God as a father? I said, frankly, what was your relationship to your father? What kind of relationship was that? And his answer was, my father was a high school superintendent principal job in Germany, and he was a very austere person, so we really didn't have a very personal relationship. So you see, I'm going now in my insights and experience with Tielicke into why did he really make such a emphasis on God as a father. See, that's in his own existence. And he was one who really, you know, these are the days, Ken, if you recall, of Bultmann and existentialism and Karl Barth, when in Europe, Tielicke was prominent like that. But more than that, Tielicke was a preacher. And in that huge audience, I went to those churches. They came from Asia, and I remember a Jap. You weren't supposed to have a camera in there taking pictures. Well, you know, I'm a photographer too, thought photography too, and TV and you know all that. So I'm image oriented, and I knew this was a historic example. So I sat there in the front row with this big German. It was cold in that church in Hamburg. I had that big German. I helped bought this overcoat there with a fur collar. I'm sitting there, and I have that camera hid inside that overcoat, taking pictures of Tielicke preaching. Because, you know, he was known as a dry man. Now, it was cold in that church. I tell you, I had that new German overcoat on, and I was cold. He worked so hard on his sermon, delivering it, that sweat was coming down his forehead.
Tielicke wanted to connect with people where they were.
Well, he did that by, you know, that wasn't hard to do. Under Nazism, this was a very existential life and death situation. You know, there were so many Germans killed in the war. You had that east-west problem with Russia. After the war, then the Russians had occupied a large section. I was in East Germany, too. Tielicke couldn't go in there. For example, curiosity about what was going on in East Germany. When Tielicke would preach, he'd take up a big offering, and that money would be sent over to the German Lutheran pastors who had retired and didn't have any money when they retired. They had no income, and or orphan children. That's where Tielicke's big offerings were sent, to help those people.
So what were some of the central themes in his preaching? You talked about his emphasis on God as a father. What else do you find again and again in the work of Tielicke?
Well, the emphasis on the Bible, it would be based on the Bible. Well, frankly, he thought the preaching, that's the way theology should be communicated. That the objectivity, the truth value of Christianity is in the congregation and in the church. And that's gone on, you know. It was always, Paul was at Thessalonica or Ephesus or somewhere, Rome. And so he was in Hamburg, and he was in a church, and he was preaching. And so it's a lot like you have in the Bible. And he would use a Bible text, like our way, the prodigal son. Well, that was one of his favorites,
mm-hmm.
The waiting father. I had a book here. We have so much ice here now, I got my whole Tielicke library in a big manuscript. I wrote about Tielicke in my library at the seminary, but I couldn't get, the car was covered with ice. I wanted to check my notes on that. But he was our waiting father. That was one emphasis on the Bible. He felt that our problems are in space and time. We're in a war. We face death. I'm just thinking of one here now. He says, I'm quoting from, this is a chapter called Descended into Hell. He says, sometimes when we must part from a loved one because he is taking a long journey, and then parentheses, as often happened during the war when a soldier had to go to the front, end of parentheses, we agree that at a certain time in the evening, we will both look at a certain star, comma, so that our gaze will meet in infinity, and we will remain linked to each other by that sparkling point of the universe. We have the same sort of link with the dead. We know the identity of the quote, in quotes, the star, to whom we may look when one of us sets out on his last journey from all things temporal. Therefore, we also know at which star our lines of sight will cross. One sees it from this world, and one from the other. Those words are in a parenthesis, this and other. For indeed, this star shines upon both. Jesus Christ is the Lord of this world and the next, keeping watch even over the uttermost parts of the sea. Apart from this link, there is no connection with those who have fallen asleep. Yet we are permitted to tell him, with a capital H, everything that is on our hearts, both our greetings and our anxious questions. He will not despise even our most foolish wishes. Even if our last murmur is too faint for any human ear, it will press upon his heart, and he will receive it. He is the star to whom we look. He is the bridge between time and eternity. In him have they lived, and in him have they died. Patriarchs, prophets, and apostles. And so it will be down to the end of time. Thus the last word can only be one of praise. Thou, O Lord, art all in all. And that's the end of that book. And a lot of that's, I think, based on the situation in which they were. There was so many people were killed. I know I myself would call on the widows who had lost their husbands, you know, in war in Germany. There were so many Germans killed. You know, when you see the statistics of how many were killed in the Second World War, it was mostly Germans and Russians. And so there was, Tillich had to deal with this issue of deaths. A lot of his writing, where do you find comfort?
So this is Christ as the one who comes as the answer to the problem that we have, and he would find even relatively small things.
Yeah.
I mean, after the war, he had to preach in a situation where there wasn't death surrounding everybody as it was when the bombs were falling and the cities were being obliterated.
That's right.
But he was still concerned to connect people with signs of their mortality, signs of the judgment of God, and more important than to show Christ as the answer for all of that.
Well, he had a great literary genius. He was a gifted writer. He was so well-educated. He's a big man. He's, I'd say, 6'3", heavy-set. I was just looking. I photographed him a lot, and I have he was about bald halfway back. This was in 1966, 67. And he was a very imposing person. When I was in the front row when he preached, he worked so hard at it, and he used gestures and modulation of his voice. You know what? He wrote a book on Spurgeon.
Uh-huh.
And you
the
know,
great 19th-century preacher.
Spurgeon was a Baptist preacher in the United States,
mm-hmm.
The well-known preacher. Such a great... So Tillich, he wanted to know how to preach. How could you do your best? And he studied how to preach. He read Spurgeon and Spurgeon's sermons. And so he wrote a book about Spurgeon, too. You know, he wrote all the time.
Well, just like he wanted to learn from Spurgeon, what do preachers today, speaking to people in a 20th century, 21st century now context?
Well, first of all, you've got to meet their needs. And the needs were, they're quite universal, but you have to be specific about it. And you have to connect their situation, their needs, with the answer, which is Christ and the Bible. For example, if it's on death, I remember he talked, faith is the boat that we cross the river Styx, the river of death with, S-T-Y-X.
Mm-hmm.
River Styx is the river of death in literature. And so we cross the river of death with faith. We trust in Jesus. So how do you handle that? Well, he goes to the resurrection of Jesus, and when Jesus appeared after the resurrection. Thomas said, he couldn't believe this, you know, he says, this. They came and told Thomas, you know, well, we're going to... People doubt, you understand? People have doubts, and so Tillich would speak to these modern doubts in secular society.
Now, okay. now you mentioned the fact that Thielicke was active along with some of the other German theologians who were his contemporaries, like Rudolf Bultmann. He was critical of Bultmann's doubts about the resurrection and doubts about the New Testament.
Bultmann doubted it. He says it's only a myth, in quotations.
Mm-hmm.
Thielicke says this is no myth. This is the eternal God touching history. You understand?
And so,
it's not a myth. It was something that was recorded by people who heard Jesus speak. Thomas doubted, too. And Jesus says, here, come and put your fingers into my side.
Thielicke's...
And see the marks in my hands. So Thielicke is saying, this is where the eternal God came in Jesus Christ in history.
Thielicke's...
History is fact.
Thielicke's work as a preacher then helped to keep him straight in his theology. Is that what you're saying?
Well, he had to... He said, you know, you use the gospel accounts of the resurrection of Jesus to answer people's questions about death. And the fact was, you can't get away and by saying, oh, this is mythology, so we're going to talk about all the mythologies of history. The people are facing death, like he said here in this one, here he says, this person who is facing death. He's facing the death of a loved one, and he says he's talking about that case, and that was very meaningful.
What can Christians today, just average lay Christians, learn from Thielicke about how to speak to their neighbors about Christ?
Well, they have to refer to the Bible. That's not number one. They themselves have to examine themselves. About their sincerity, and to what extent are they authentic? You know, I've heard people after I preach, they say, well, you preach like you believe it. You remember that?
So did Thielicke.
Huh?
So did Thielicke, is what you're saying.
Yeah, he believed it. So, but that's faith. That's what crosses the river of death. The river Styx. And he had that. You could tell. Well, of course, it wasn't that hard either. I guess you have to say... and he wouldn't deny this either. In fact, he said that. He had an illustration about the work of the Holy Spirit. He said that he remembered the cathedral at Chartres in France, when the light would shine through the stained glass window in there, then you would see how the Holy Spirit works when these facts of history, say you see the picture of Jesus there, or the Mother Mary and Jesus, whatever you're seeing from the Bible in that picture window, that light is, and that your experience of it is translated, the Holy Spirit touches us so we can interpret that positively. You understand? I watched in those big cathedrals in Europe, some of these people came in there, and, well, it was just another part of culture, like going in a museum. But Thielicke sees Christianity as more than a museum, as an object of archaeological digs.
Yeah, it's a living, vital thing.
All right, you got underline that word living.
We've got to run. Thank you very much. We hit the high point, and I guess now we have to close. Dr. Harold Zietlow, Professor Emeritus of Practical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne. Thank you for talking to us about Helmut Thielicke. We'll be back to talk about Mars.
Preaching Christ and Him Crucified. You're listening to Issues, etc.
The psalmist writes in the 44th Psalm, "Awake, O Lord, why do you sleep? Rouse yourself. Do not reject us forever. Why do you hide your face and forget our misery and oppression?" Have you ever felt a little like the psalmist? That God had become your enemy? You'll find an in-depth study of the Complaint Psalms in our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for January, titled, When God Becomes My Enemy. Visit our website, issuesetc.org, for more information on this book, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The cost is $19.99 plus shipping and handling, 1-800-325-3040. Is it a sin to complain to God? And if God is omniscient, can He be persuaded to change His course of action? Find out with the book, When God Becomes My Enemy, our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for January. Issuesetc.org or 1-800-325-3040.
DNA Computer. It's God's technology. Answers with Ken Ham, one of the editors and contributing writers for Creation Magazine. Well, Ken, I've heard about some new technology about computers using the DNA molecule. But what do you mean when you say it's God's technology?
Well, silicon chip technology is almost at its limit of miniaturization. So computer engineers have been looking to the DNA molecule and its phenomenal information processing and storage capacity to boost computer power. You know, it's been estimated that just 1 gram of dried DNA can hold as much information as a trillion CDs. Now, Israeli researchers have announced a design for a tiny biochemical computer that is not just made of DNA, but also powered by DNA. With no need of any external power source, these DNA computers could have medical applications. If doctors were to place them in the human body, they could possibly identify certain physical malfunctions. They are so small that one droplet could hold 3 trillion of these DNA computers, which could perform an amazing 66 billion operations per second. Mind-blowing, isn't it? Isn't it remarkable that when human technology reaches its limit, we turn to what God created in the beginning and find that it's so much more superior? What a wonderful creator we have.
Some of the most asked questions about the Christian faith are answered on our website, AnswersRadio.com. Look for our free booklets at AnswersRadio.com.
AM 850 KFUO weather for St. Louis. Overnight, partly cloudy. It's going to be a bitter cold tonight, low of about 6. For tomorrow, mostly sunny. The sun's not going to help us. We'll still be in the mid-20s. We'll call it high near 26 tomorrow. And in St. Louis right now, it's overcast and 21. Wind chill right now is 7 above zero.
Is this how you feel as a parent? Like a frightened chicken, afraid the sky might fall on your family any moment? Focus on the Family with Dr. James Dobson can help keep you from chickening out on your most vital role, being the parent your kids need most. Keep parenting in perspective with Focus on the Family, heard weekdays right here.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Next time on the Bible study, we'll talk about the post-resurrection appearances of Jesus and his ascension. It's the very last part of the Gospel of Luke in chapter 24. We'll discuss it with Pastor Kurt Taylor of St. John's Lutheran Church in Waltz, Michigan. The Bible study is heard weekday mornings at 10:05. Luke 24, next time.
The Bible study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
One of the new facts about our world and our solar system in the new year of 2004 is Mars exploration. There's a probe and another one on the way to kind of run around the face of Mars and take some pictures and send back all kinds of data. We're going to be talking about that in this closing hour of Issues Etc. this afternoon, closing half hour, I should say. I'm Ken Sherb for the vacationing Todd Wilkin, and our guest is Pastor Jim Heiser, pastor of Salem Lutheran Church in Malone, Texas. He has been involved in a kind of a shirt-tail way with the National Aeronautics and Space Administration and their intentions for Mars exploration. Jim, how are you this afternoon?
Just fine, Kent. Good to be speaking with you again.
Last time we talked about Mars exploration on this program was, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago. Yeah. Obviously, a lot has happened. But before we go into the most recent events, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got involved in this to the extent that you have?
Oh, I'd be glad to. I became involved with an organization called the Mars Society back in 1998 when it was first being founded. A group of scientists who had been involved directly with NASA and also through companies that did a lot of work with NASA had decided that they wanted to do more in terms of public outreach to organize people both within the technical community and also just folks who were interested in knowing more about space and about Mars in particular into an organization which would seek to begin to actively lobby for more direct science being done and also to look at possibilities for humans to Mars missions. And I had been in some contact with the primary mover behind this effort, Dr. Robert Zubrin, the author of the book Case for Mars. And when he sent out the appeal for folks to attend the first convention of the Mars Society, I made sure that I was there and have just become more involved over the years with the Society.
So, could you tell us a little bit, by way of a thumbnail sketch, of what's been happening here with these landers and what kind of a step forward that really represents in Mars exploration?
Oh, this is a marvelous success, which we witnessed the last few days. With the success of another lander, this is the first successful lander since Pathfinder back in 97. And with this new lander, hopefully to be followed by the lander named Opportunity on January 25th, it's going to give us the opportunity to get a lot more direct science back from Mars in terms of knowledge of the soil, knowledge of the rocks, studying to see whether there had been water at one time standing on the surface of Mars, and really tracking what's happened with the climate change over the years.
What exactly do scientists expect that this is going to show? I know during the 1960s, as moon exploration was all the rage, some people were speculating almost metaphysically and yes, even theologically, that this would give us all sorts of insights into the nature of life and the nature of our solar system. People at NASA were making big predictions even about how this would change the face of religion. Mm-hmm. What kind of expectations are there about these probes to Mars?
They are much more guarded now. What they're hoping for are the relatively modest and, I believe, attainable goals of trying to determine whether there had been, at one time, standing water. We know how important water is for life on our own world, and they're trying to determine whether Mars ever had a temperature warm enough for life, whether water was ever present in a liquid form, to see whether there's even the possibility, scientifically speaking, that life could have existed at one time on Mars. You don't hear as much speculation, at least within the credible scientific community, about trying to address larger, almost metaphysical issues. They've, after getting rather badly burned, I think, in the late 60s, have become more cautious about such pronouncements.
In what ways do they think they got burned?
Well, in that They had raised expectations to such a point where the Darwinists really believed that they had the creationists on the run, and when they just simply were not able to disprove a divine origin of life, I think that they were gravely disappointed in their failures.
See, that comes as no surprise to me and
of
no
course.
Shock, but I was wondering how they saw it, and you're saying that they've been kind of chastened by this.
I believe so, and it's led them to be a little more responsible and a little less extreme in their statements. Now, I'm not speaking of NASA, of course, as an institution, but just the kind of voices you hear coming out of the scientific community and what you see really in the popular literature. Generally speaking, scientists are fairly careful bunch when it comes to speculating about what they may be able to determine. It's when things get run through the mill of popularizing it, in other words, what we see in Newsweek and Time and so forth, that far less cautious statements tend to get promulgated.
Now, you have had the opportunity also to minister to people in these settings. Could you describe that to
Indeed.
Us a bit?
Indeed. I've had the opportunity to speak at four different conventions of the Mars Society now. And what I've found in dealing with these individuals on a one-on-one basis is that far from being hostile to the Christian faith and to an interest in religion in general, they're actually very curious about learning more about our perspective. Title for one of my papers just this last summer at the convention last August was entitled The Heavens Declare the Glory of God, a Theological Perspective on the Exploration and Colonization of Mars. And it filled the room, frankly, not because of me, but because of interest in the topic.
Well, I mean, you're talking about God. That ought to get people's attention.
Exactly. And I was extremely pleased that they did not in any way view this as somehow an irrelevant topic. It was something that they did not necessarily feel comfortable addressing themselves, but were curious to see what Christians would have to say.
Well, I'm curious, too. Could you give me a little précis of what you said in that paper?
Sure. The entire thing is predicated on the Christian understanding that, as the psalmist declares, the heavens declare the glory of God, that there are things that we can indeed learn about God's work in creation from studying that good creation, and that I basically held before them three main points which Christians could bring to the endeavor, and the first one was hope. In the perspective that when we look at the creation, we see, although, of course, that it is greatly damaged by the fall, nevertheless, the work of a loving God at work within that creation. There was a very insightful statement by a fellow by the name of Houston Smith a few years ago, where he observed that for the scientific worldview, in his words, there's no way that a happy ending can be worked into it, it being the creation. Death is the grim reaper of individual lives, and whether things as a whole will end in a freeze or a fry, with a bang or a whimper, is anybody's guess. And for us as Christians, rather than looking with a numbed fear at what the future holds for the creation, we see the work of God. We expect to see planning to it. We expect to see blessings that can be derived from studying it. And that is something that they found a very interesting perspective. It ultimately, the scientific endeavor is a very bleak one when you believe that there is no purpose and no hope. And that is the worldview that is held by so many within the scientific community today.
And the ironic thing is that science as we know it today would not have had its foundations in the late Middle Ages and the early modern period had it not been for Christians who had that sort of hopeful perspective.
Exactly. Christianity brought to the scientific endeavor the belief that the world could be meaningfully studied, that it was comprehensible. For many of the pagan worldviews, the idea that you could meaningfully study nature was deemed to be impossible.
Why even try?
Exactly. But for us, since Christianity saw that there was a purpose to it all, that this had been established by a rational and loving creator, we simply went looking for how the pieces all fit together. We assumed such an order. And indeed, that order has been revealed.
Okay, so you talked about three points. You said the first was hope.
Right. And the second was love and the desire to serve the neighbor. That, again, this is occurring in the context of discussion of exploration and possibly colonization of Mars. And that I just made the observation that the harsh reality of life in such a situation necessitated that settlers had to be prepared for self-sacrifice for the sake of one's neighbor, and that selfishness, which views others only in terms of what they can do for me, rather than looking at life in terms of how I might best serve others, is a vice that space colonization cannot afford. If we are only out for ourselves and not for the service of others, we're really rather parasitical.
Now, how did they react to that one?
They certainly agreed with that, because this is a community which recognizes that there is indeed great personal risk involved in all work in space. Down here in Texas, we had a particularly horrific example of that when the shuttle blew up not that far from where I live. It literally rattled the windows of our home. And it brought home to one the fact that this is a very dangerous endeavor that we're talking about. And they readily acknowledged that there was a need for such a willingness to sacrifice for one's neighbor.
Okay, and then point three?
The third point was that just simply that we are motivated in our study of creation. It's not something we're afraid of, because we seek to learn more about God's plan for the universe in studying what he reveals concerning himself in the creation. In other words, that we believe it glorifies him, so of course we want to study it. We're not hiding under our beds afraid of what science might reveal, not when we're speaking of true science. And that was a helpful argument, I think, to present to them, because many of these individuals were used to dealing with a certain kind of self-described fundamentalism which denigrates the entire scientific endeavor, which, you know, views it with suspicion and almost a fear of what the scientists might uncover. Mm-hmm. For us, there is no such fear, because we know that it's God's hand that's at work in it. Men can try to twist what they learn from the creation, but that's a matter of misusing the facts, not any fear of the facts of nature themselves.
We're talking about Mars exploration with Pastor Jim Heiser of Salem Lutheran Church in Malone, Texas. If you want to give us a call, we've got about 10 minutes or so left in this half hour. For your questions and comments, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Again, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. What are the realistic prospects of actual colonization of Mars?
That is what we're trying to find out right now. There's a lot of factors that go into that, and among other things, we have to find out whether there's water which is easily accessible by potential explorers or colonists. And with missions such as Spirit and Opportunity, as well as the orbiters that are presently in place, they're trying to find out what degree of accessibility there is to water, to basic minerals, and whether this is even possible to proceed further. I suspect that what we'll probably see is, over the next 10 to 15 years, further plans for a first manned expedition to Mars, but we'll just have to kind of wait and see.
So there's a lot riding on the explorers that are on the surface now and later this month.
Potentially, yes. Now, that doesn't mean that if these fail, they won't try again. Certainly, they'll keep trying to learn more, but potentially the yield could be quite good from this exploration.
How long did it take these explorers to make it to Mars?
It was right around 7 months.
Okay.
This was a particularly good year for a launch. As probably many of your listeners are aware, this was a year of a particularly close opposition between Mars and the Earth. In fact, it was the closest of the two planets had been to each other in history.
Oh.
And it made for an even shorter distance between the worlds for the launch than one normally expects. Roughly every 2 years, we get a good launch window. And that's why it'll seem like several years will pass with no news, because we're waiting for the next window.
Mm-hmm. When's the next one expected to occur that'll be anywhere near favorable? In a couple of years?
Yeah, in about 2 years, we'll have another good window.
I see.
But probably folks heard about the European Space Agency's lander, which unfortunately did not succeed. That was supposed to have touched down on Christmas Day. And they, to the best of my knowledge, there was no signal received back from it at all. And that, of course, had folks rather nervous to see what would happen with Spirit and Opportunity.
Now, you were describing the points that you made in your most recent presentation to the Mars Society, points
mm-hmm.
about hope and love and self-sacrifice and not being motivated out of fear. Finally, though, you're going to come to the heart of the faith in tying those explicitly to Christ, who is the hope of the world,
yes,
and who
absolutely.
Is the one who sacrificed himself, giving himself as a ransom for us all, and in whom we don't have to fear, because there is no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. I'd like you to talk to me a little bit, and to our audience, about the opportunities that this kind of exploration, or even the prospect of this kind of exploration, can open up to enable Christians to talk to their neighbors.
Well, and that was my point briefly in touching before on just giving them an opportunity to hear Christians who were open to discussion of scientific matters. If they, you can get a long way with a person if you're willing to listen to them and talk to them about the things that are of great importance to them. And they don't lack for a curiosity about religious matters. It's just normally what they tend to encounter are folks who aren't really interested in engaging in a dialogue. What I've found is that every year that I go, there will be anywhere from a handful to 15 to 20 individuals who approach me one at a time saying, you know, that they want to talk about the hope that is ours in Christ. In one example that comes to mind immediately was one fellow just this last year who really kind of broke down talking about some personal issues that had come up within his own life, and he just normally did not have the opportunity to speak with a believer. He was not a member of a church. A member of his family who was a believer had passed away, and he wanted to better understand this faith that had been sustaining this loved one of theirs.
And he was much more willing to talk to you because you were willing to be interested in what he was doing.
Right. I was in a sense part of his community.
It wasn't the
exposure you might get of going down to the church on the corner and speaking with someone that you didn't know how much you had in common with them. You were willing to meet them halfway.
Mm-hmm. We've got a caller on the line. Matt from Richmond Heights wants to ask, I think, about the water on the planet's surface.
Okay.
Matt, you're on Issues Etc. Go ahead.
It's a wonderful discussion right now, and I'm enjoying it thoroughly.
Thank you.
The Holy Grail seems to be, at least in the popular media, finding water on Mars, you know, so that meant that there's some kind of connection to life on another planet. And I just wonder what... are there other things that could have caused the flows up there, liquid this or that, other than water? And what do you think about water having been on Mars?
Well, you know, there are other possibilities. It is possible that one other source that's been given for some of the channeling could possibly be through off-gassing of frozen carbon dioxide, for example, causing the soil to collapse under it as the frozen gases would melt. But that's largely been dismissed now, and most of the scientific community believes that the channeling and so forth was caused on the surface was caused by water. I don't see any particular theological problem, if you will, with the theory of there being water there. However, the presence of water doesn't prove the existence of life or its origin. In other words, there's a lot of layers to this, to the question. And I fully expect that at some point they will come up with ready evidence of significant quantities of water. We already know for a certainty that there is water there right now because there's ice at the pole. And they've also found photographic evidence of water, ice, mist from rising from some of the craters right after sunrise. But the quantity of water has really been the big issue, and whether there was ever a standing ocean, for example, in the northern hemisphere. And those are the kind of things that they're trying to settle now.
I want to get back to this point about witness and how the mm-hmm. church and how the individual Christian can kind of take this as an opportunity. Maybe we need to make it clear, you don't necessarily need to be personally convinced that Mars exploration mm-hmm. is feasible or even a good idea to be looking into in order to engage people in conversation about Mars exploration.
Exactly, but you do need to be willing to at least become familiar with some of the topics at hand. And if I could just make a couple of recommendations in terms of background reading, two books that are worth paying some attention to would be Dr. Robert Zubrin's The Case for Mars, and another volume, which is a collection of essays from Mars Society conventions, is entitled On to Mars, Colonizing a New World. If you're going to engage in conversation with these folks, it does help if you know a little bit about what all is involved in the current state of science, what their hopes are, and so forth. That helps to open the door for discussion.
I dare say more of us are going to be talking with people who just hear about this on the TV news, read about it in a news magazine like Newsweek or Time. We're not all going to be at the Mars Society are, although I'm intensely glad that you're there, Jim. It's like you're an apostle to this particular group of people. But most of us, in an opportunity to just sort of rub shoulders with people who have heard something the previous evening about the Mars lander, give us some pointers. What do we do? What do we say? How can we work this conversation around so we can talk about Christ?
Well, and I think the first place you start with is the Christian affirmation that, indeed, this is part of the good creation that God has established. That, you know, we're excited about it, too, because any Christian should want to know more about this, these worlds which the Lord has created. And when you have forced the door open that much, you've already gotten past one of the major obstacles, which is the media stereotype adhered to by many people, that Christians are somehow afraid of science and afraid of what it might show. Express a genuine interest in knowing more about this world, not just to say it, but to really mean it. Be aware of how these things are developing, but also be aware of what to watch out for in terms of the grand assumptions. The media will very quickly jump, and people will just sort of repeat it, that, you know, somehow if it were established that there was water or life on Mars or other worlds, that somehow that disproves God. Far from it. We expect to see the signs of God's work within his creation, and water does not prove anything in and of itself. And even if we were to find life there, to go way out on the limb of the realm of the possible, just to discuss the hypothetical, even if we were to find that, that says nothing against God. I'm not aware of anything in the Bible which says that he would have been incapable of creating some form of life elsewhere.
Well, it is a fascinating prospect, and a fascinating prospect for Christian testimony to the God who has revealed himself above all in our Lord Jesus Christ.
Indeed.
Pastor Jim Heiser, pastor at Salem Lutheran Church in Malone, Texas, thank you for updating us on what's going on with Mars exploration.
Thank you, Pastor Sherb.
It is great to talk to you. Well, that's about it for this afternoon. I think we're going to have a couple of days of the best of Issues Etc. here on tape. Todd is back at the microphone on Thursday, and then he's interviewing Mike Horton on Sunday night on the Sunday Night Show. I'm Ken Sherb for Todd. It's been a ball being with you on Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.